Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Today's episode is presented by EIT Raw Materials. EIT Raw Materials is on a mission to develop sustainable raw material supply into a major strength for Europe. Join us at the Raw Materials Summit from May 14th through 16th in Brussels. Find out more at EITRMSummit.com.
Today, at the summit, NATO leaders decided a fundamental shift in our defense and deterrence to respond to a new security reality.
Welcome to EU Confidential, Europe's number one politics podcast. I'm Sarah Wheaton, Politico's chief policy correspondent, taking over the hosting chair for this week. And for political junkies in Brussels and arguably around the world, it's been quite a week. We started out with a G7 summit, a meeting of the leaders of the world's largest developed economies in a German castle in the Bavarian Alps.
Since the G7 last year, we've made significant progress together.
And what's really struck me has been the amazing consistency.
And this is the one and only way to maximize the potential of our investments.
I told Putin that if he invaded Ukraine, NATO would not only get stronger, but would get more united.
And culminating on Thursday with what some are calling a historic summit of 30 NATO members along with allies in Madrid. At the beginning of the podcast, you heard NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg. He was announcing important decisions made by the alliance in recent days.
We will strengthen our forward defenses. We will enhance our battle groups in the eastern part of the alliance up to brigade levels. We will transform the NATO response force and increase the number of high readiness forces to well over 300,000.
Now, if all that sounded like a bunch of military jargon, stay tuned. Our Politico team on the ground in Madrid will unpack what it really means, especially for European countries in the East. Also making headlines this week,
NATO leaders took the historic decision to invite Finland and Sweden to become members of NATO. The agreement concluded last night by Turkey, Finland and Sweden paved the way for this decision.
We'll get more details from our podcast panel on how the deal was done. And you'll also hear from Swedish Prime Minister Magdalena Andersson on how she expects things to move forward.
The response from Russia has been rather mild, which I think makes a lot of sense.
Also in this episode, we have the Prime Ministers of Norway and Estonia and their takes on how what's happened in Madrid will impact their regions. But first, let's get to our podcast panel for the inside scoop from both the G7 and NATO summits. What was achieved, or maybe more importantly, what issues weren't addressed? We recorded our conversation live on Twitter earlier Thursday as our reporters were wrapping up at the NATO summit in Madrid. They include Lily Beyer, our senior reporter covering NATO, David Herzenhorn, our chief Brussels correspondent, Paul McCleary, who covers defense for Politico US, and Hans von der Boischard, our Brussels politics reporter. I started out asking Lily whether the announcements we just heard from Jens Stoltenberg went far enough.
This is quite a historic summit. I think the big thing that the allies decided on is a new strategic concept. This is a document that was last done in 2010, and this is a kind of long-term strategic blueprint for the alliance. It has a lot of really important changes in terms of how the alliance sees the world and its role. So, for example, the new strategic concept states that the Russian Federation is the most significant and direct threat to the Allies' security and to peace and stability in the Euro-Atlantic area. The leaders said in this document that they will significantly strengthen deterrence and defense. And also, for the first time, they actually included China in this document, stating that China's stated ambitions and coercive policies are challenging our interests, security, and values. But at the same time, they also said that NATO remains open to constructive engagement with China.
Thanks, Lily. And David Herzenhorn, our chief Brussels correspondent, let me go to you. You've been covering NATO for a long time. I know that in this strategic document that Lily was just talking about, there had been kind of an earlier draft had talked more about China and had talked about space. You know, is NATO sort of having to move backwards a bit?
This really, the war in Ukraine obviously forced NATO to rethink itself and reinvent itself on the fly. Certainly, they were trying to pivot, the U.S. especially, trying to lead the alliance in a pivot toward China and the new threats in Asia. And in fact, that was made impossible by Vladimir Putin's invasion of Ukraine. So a lot of this was expected in the context of the return of war to Europe, which, as Lily was getting at, is just remarkable to think about full-scale war being waged on the European continent in the 21st century. And in many ways, this is even more dangerous than at the height of the Cold War. There was not a hot war going on in those days. A lot of the nuclear nonproliferation architecture that existed back then has disintegrated. What was a kind of a conflict balanced by two superpowers has become much more disorganized. So lots of unpredictable factors here. But when you listen to a summit, as we have these last days, with plans for hundreds of thousands of NATO troops available to defend on the eastern flank, and the NATO Secretary General, as he did at his closing news conference, pointedly warning Putin that if he tries anything like what he did in Georgia in 2008 or in Ukraine in 2014 or now in 2022 on NATO territory, there is going to be a very, very big war.
We have so significantly increased our presence in the eastern part of the alliance with more than 40,000 troops under direct NATO command to remove any room for miscalculation, misunderstanding in Moscow about our readiness to protect every inch of NATO territory. And that's NATO's core responsibility, to make sure that there is no misunderstanding in the minds of any adversary, that if they do anything like what Russia has done to Georgia in 2008 or Ukraine now, that will trigger the full response from the whole alliance. And that's the main message.
Thanks, David. That's really great kind of high-level perspective. Hans van der Borchardt, you are looking into some of the details of these plans. For example, where are some of these 300,000 troops going to be coming from? Can you help us get into the nitty-gritty a bit here?
Yes, hello. So it's still a bit unclear because basically this announcement of the 300,000 troops left everybody a bit puzzling what he was referring to, because many of the countries were not really, they didn't know that he would bring up this figure. They thought it might be a bit high. For example, Germany then said a day later that they would provide around 15,000 soldiers. It might be 17,000, might only be 13 or 14,000. It really depends on what kind of brigade they're going to send there. And they might also send some ships, some planes. So it might be all ratcheted up to, let's say, 25,000 soldiers. But Germany, for example, is the biggest troop provider in Europe and NATO. So if they only deliver about 15 to 25,000, then you can imagine that it will be hard to even come to this 300,000. So there's a lot of uncertainties here.
Yeah, it sounds like it's a bit hard to tell when this is all going to actually happen. But one concrete outcome that we saw is that Turkey has unblocked its veto, allowing Sweden and Finland to move forward with their NATO bids. Lily, can you tell us, what do we know about what Turkey ultimately got out of this deal?
So Turkey, Sweden, and Finland signed a trilateral memorandum right on the eve of the summit. And basically, the governments in Helsinki and Stockholm made a series of promises. They reassured Turkey that they're taking issues like terrorism seriously. There was mention of Kurdish groups like the PKK, and also some assurances on extradition, though those remain flimsy because, of course, Finland and Sweden have to be careful to remain in line with standards of the rule of law in their own countries. So I would say that ultimately this deal is in large part symbolic. We just heard President Erdogan here briefing the press. I think he was trying to present this deal as a win. He, of course, is trying to speak in part to his domestic audience, to portray himself as a serious player on the international stage. But for NATO allies, the key thing about this memorandum is that it did lead to Ankara lifting its block on Sweden and Finland's membership applications. So now these applications can proceed. Though, as a reminder, the 30 current allies do need to ratify the accession.
And Paul McClear, let's go to you. You are a defense reporter for Politico US. Thank you for joining us here. President Biden has referred to Finland and Sweden's accession as the NATOization of Europe. How do you think we can expect the relationship between the U.S. and Europe to be different moving forward? Are they on the same page about Putin's calculus in the region and their general approach to supporting Ukraine?
So far, yeah. It seems that there's broad consensus across NATO about how to deal with Russia and Ukraine and supplying Ukrainian forces. It seems to be kind of a long-term approach that U.S. officials and NATO officials have all kind of described over the past few days of sustaining support for Ukraine in the long haul. I had a few diplomats kind of mentioned next spring and summer as a time for some major offensives, which Ukrainians might not be fully on board with. The Ukrainian officials have expressed a lot of concern that NATO isn't moving fast enough, particularly this summer and this fall, in order to try to push the Russians back. And they're worried that NATO is going to slow roll some of this support.
Well, yeah, and that reminds me of this issue where it's not really clear if NATO and Western countries are actually on the same page with Kyiv about how to proceed. I mean, obviously, Kyiv wants a lot more support, but just in general, this question of whether we continue in stalemate or if some sort of action should be taken to kind of speed things along towards an end in one direction or the other. David, what are you hearing on this?
Well, it's clear, and President Biden cited some of the poll numbers in Ukraine showing that Ukrainians will not surrender territory for peace with Russia. It's past that point. So the West won't have much say in this, and European leaders have smartly kind of gotten ahead of that now, where they've made clear that the only peace that will come will be a peace that is decided by Ukraine. President Zelensky and his team have indicated that at a minimum, that would mean pushing Russia back to pre-February 24th positions, means them occupying small parts of Donetsk and Lugansk. But again, to tilt the conflict in that direction would require a dramatically different approach. Either NATO getting directly involved, which they don't want to do, or sending Ukraine the more advanced weapons, both offensive weapons, longer range artillery, and more serious missile defense capabilities that would then allow them to really make a push and force Russian forces out of areas like Kherson, the so-called land bridge that now runs to the Crimean Peninsula from Mariupol, which we know is mostly destroyed, to almost to Mykolaiv in the west. So a lot of the Ukrainian coastline now occupied by Russian forces, and it'll take a lot to get those forces out of there.
Well, so let's go back to Paul on that one. The U.S. will send more destroyers, air defense systems, and redeploy troops further east in the coming months. Was this a surprising announcement, and how is it landing with the American public? And last, will it move the needle, do we think?
It's not much of a surprise, really. I think a lot of this is part of the new NATO force posture in the Baltics and in the east. The ships, the Navy told me today, won't get to Spain until 2024 and 2026. And that's the Spanish Parliament first has to agree to it as well, to increase the U.S. Destroyer count in Rota, Spain, from 4 to 6. So, I mean, that's not going to happen for several years yet. The brigade that's going to Romania, still unclear when that's going to go, where that brigade's coming from, probably from Germany, one of the striker brigades that's actually in Romania now. They might stay. The missile defense, again, up in the air. There's not a lot of detail. I asked DoD officials, and they don't have much more than a fact sheet, even, you know, kind of on background. So I think this was announced, you know, in good faith, but I don't think that anything is going to happen very quickly. The brigade can happen relatively quickly. The rest of it, I think we have to wait. Washington still needs to talk to national governments to smooth the way. There probably needs to be some infrastructure, things like that. So it's not going to be anything within the coming weeks, most likely.
Great. Thank you. So let's build a bridge with the other big event that we've been talking about this week. And that's the G7 event that we had earlier in Germany. David, just kind of stepping back and looking at both of these events, you know, what was kind of the general vibe, and was there a difference between the two events?
Well, of course, the big powers at the G7, the United States, Germany, Canada, France, the UK, Italy, they are all, except for Japan, actually, they're members of NATO as well. So quite a lot of common thinking. And in fact, the Japanese Prime Minister was at the NATO summit to talk about issues related to security in the Far East. China, again, seen along with Russia as you know, a persistent and rising threat, not quite as immediate and present as Russia. So what we do see are, you know, like-minded allies trying to wave forward in this really uncertain and different security environment, but they don't have good answers. They don't want to get into this war. That's very, very clear. They know that that could lead to a nuclear conflict with Vladimir Putin. They want to step up their sanctions, but many of the options that they're looking at have proven to be contradictory. So they want to sanction Russian oil and at the same time realize that that's driving up the price. Then they want to put a cap on oil prices, but realizing that'll drive down the prices and increase the use of fossil fuels, which in terms of their climate change goals goes directly in contradiction. I mean, we saw another remarkable development where the UK was promising £1 billion more in assistance for Ukraine, but also saying that some of that money would come from unspent climate funds. So in a way, selling out future generations to deal with this immediate conflict. So you can't envy world leaders at the moment, the leaders of the Western powers, who are really struggling to find policy prescriptions for a very, very dangerous, uncertain time.
Hans, the G7 was the first big international summit hosted by German Chancellor Olaf Scholz. How did he do? What are the reviews?
For Scholz, it was generally a good summit. Also, the NATO summit was good for him, the outcome, because he could really show this unity among Western leaders. And you could see him on the public part of the bilateral we had with the U.S. president, where he got lots of praise from Joe Biden, and he had this big smile on his face. You usually see Scholz more more stern, more serious, and there you could see him being really, really happy. And also yesterday evening, when a couple of German journalists saw the chancellor for a background talk, we really had the feeling we're seeing a different person here because he was so relaxed, so happy. So I think this was a really relief for him that this summit worked so well. And I think in general, the summit or both summits, or let's say all the three summits, because we had the European Council before, worked quite well for the German chancellor in the sense that he could push through some of his goals. And there was a bit more of the German leadership, which is we've been missing for a couple of months now.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's now take this moment to move on to a lightning round to finish up. I'm going to ask each of you, what's one decision that was made over the past week that you think has potential for real impact? Lily, let's start with you on that one.
I think for me, it's an easy one. Sweden and Finland moving toward accession. This is something that is not only important for the alliance, you know, in the coming weeks and months, but possibly decades. It really redefines strategically what the alliance can do. And it's a big problem for Vladimir Putin.
Thank you. Good, speedy answer, Paul.
That was clearly number one. I mean, I think the NATO's view toward the Asia Pacific and China and bringing the leaders of Japan, South Korea, New Zealand, and Australia to the meeting is a very big deal. It's still unclear what the plan is here for how NATO is going to engage in the Indo-Pacific region. But the fact that they're looking there underscores, you know, the global supply chains, things like that, and that it is a global economy, and global economies and their health do affect security, national security, and international security.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Hans.
Maybe just to stress that the support for Ukraine, the military support, is still very much on. There were concerns ahead of the summit also that there's a certain fatigue that's growing in Western democracies when it comes to supporting Ukraine and also dealing with the consequences when it comes to Germany, for example, on gas, where now the government is admitting that we are facing a really, really harsh winter potentially in Germany with Russian gas potentially, or Germany and in Europe in broader sense being cut off from Russian gas. But the message from the NATO summit is really that there is going to be continued support with heavy weapons countries as Italy and potentially sending new howitzers, but also talk about, for example, German Leopard tanks that might eventually be sent to Ukraine. There's some discussions about that still continue. So I think that is an important takeaway as well.
Thanks. And David, if other people have already covered your answers on the most important decision, we also would love to hear your take on the biggest missed opportunity.
Well, first on the decisions, I would say it's the fact that they're taking these decisions together. All of them are super important. But the fact that even if they're making mistakes, they're saying, you know, they are utterly unified and are not going to tolerate this stuff from Putin. You know, that's remarkable. And the club is growing of countries that are making these decisions together with Finland and Sweden going in. Maybe the biggest missed opportunity at the G7 to find a sort of more coherent economic way forward to avoid some of the contradictions in some of their decisions there. Clearly, this warning that we heard from Jens Stoltenberg, the Secretary General of NATO, at the end of this summit, that if Russia tries to pull any of what it did in Georgia in 2008 or in Ukraine in 2022, you know, there will be a big war and, you know, the buck stops there. Obviously, that also an opportunity that he took to sort of draw the red line for Vladimir Putin.
All right. Well, David, Hans, Lily, Paul, thank you so much. Before we take a short break, Lily caught up with the Prime Minister of Estonia, Kaja Kallas, a voice you heard on the podcast back in February of this year. Lily asked Kallas the same question I just asked our Politico team. What stood out to her as the biggest achievement of the NATO summit?
There were a few. I think the overall summit was successful. So first of all, understanding and putting into wording that Russia is the most direct and imminent threat to the Allied security. I think this is the most important. Then the second for us is, of course, that everybody has heard our concerns, uh-huh. and we move from the tripwire concept or the deterrence posture to defense posture. Uh-huh. I think this is very important. And, of course, the content of it is that we are bolstering the eastern flank and the defense of our region, because the level of aggression has risen. And the third, of course, is welcoming Finland and Sweden to NATO. I think this is a very strong signal that, first of all, NATO is an alliance that new members want to aspire to join. Mm-hmm. And second of all, it will make NATO much stronger, considering that these are two strong countries and we will have Baltic Sea more secure, and we will also have the NATO's center of gravity moving to north.
Right after this short break, Lily is back with her conversations with the prime ministers of Sweden and Norway. They give their takes on the summit and the impact the war in Ukraine is having on Europe's northern reaches. Stay with us.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
A message from EIT Raw Materials. EIT Raw Materials is on a mission, developing Europe's raw material supply for a sustainable future. Its goal is to transform Europe's raw materials industry into a powerhouse of innovation, replacing our dependency on fossil fuels with renewable energy sources. To do this, highly skilled workforces are being educated to automate, digitalize, and electrify existing systems that promise to radically transform the sector. By supporting startups and talent, attracting investment, and connecting industry, EIT Raw Materials places modern mineral production center stage of radical innovation and technology development. Join us at the Raw Materials Summit from May 14th through 16th in Brussels. Find out more at EITRMSummit.com.
As we just discussed in our panel, Sweden and Finland reached a historic deal this week to join NATO. Politico's Lily Beyer and David Herzenhorn spoke with Swedish Prime Minister Magdalena Andersson in Madrid the morning after the deal was sealed. As you'll hear, there was a lot of commotion and background noise as the summit organizers prepared for another busy day. Lily and David began by asking Andersson when Sweden expects to fully become a member of NATO.
The timeline we have also always said from the Swedish government that we expect this could take up to a year. But to be honest, it's not up to us, but now it's up. It will be up to the 30 parliaments in the NATO countries. But we know that these processes can take some time, and therefore it was so important for me to, together with the Finnish president and prime minister, to work hard to get the security assurances that we got from countries like the United States, United Kingdom, France, Germany, Spain, where we are, so that we would be safe during this period before we become full members.
You have a very long tradition of neutrality. How will NATO membership change your willingness to get involved potentially in conflicts beyond your borders?
I mean, we do have a long tradition of being a neutral country. Well, not neutral, actually, since we became members of the European Union, but we have been without part of being a military alliance. And we've also been a strong voice in the world. But if we just look across the border to Norway, they have been members of NATO since it was founded. And they're also a very strong voice in the world for peace, security and democracy for all. So we will continue to be that strong voice also as members of NATO.
And you've been a strong voice in some
at least as long as I'm prime minister. Like I cannot speak for others.
Like North Korea or Iran, I mean, Sweden has always played a crucial role in international diplomacy. Can you talk about the threat of Russian reprisal? What threats do you assess? What are more likely? What are you preparing for? Is it from the north, from more diplomatic, cyber? I mean, obviously, Moscow is not pleased with this.
No, but on the other hand, the response from Russia has been rather mild, which I think makes a lot of sense. Russia knows that we have been a partner to NATO for a long time, that we have had a close cooperation with NATO for many years. And so maybe they don't see this as such a big step, which could also make sense. But of course, we have increased our preparedness for potential response from Russia, for instance, when it comes to cyber.
And so is your sense that Russia respects, understands that it doesn't want to be in a bad dynamic with Sweden, particularly individually, not just as a NATO ally, that it respects Sweden's capabilities in defense?
Well, I mean, we do have a strong defense in Sweden and in Finland, and of course also with the security assurances that we have from other NATO countries. I think that means a lot right now.
And what will Sweden...
But what I would say also is I think it makes sense with Russia having a broad and mild response.
And what will your government, your military, bring to NATO as an alliance in the short run? So are you planning, for example, to send troops on rotations to the Baltic states? Are you planning to reinforce other allies? So what are you bringing to the table in short?
Yes, and I think this is important. I mean, becoming a member of NATO is something that, of course, would increase security in Sweden and Finland. But we have the ambition and we will be security providers to NATO as a whole and to all NATO countries. And I think that is important. We are right now in the midst of the largest buildup of our military or our defense since the 50s, and we are want to reach 2% of GDP as soon as practically possible, and that will be at the latest at 2028. And we have reactivated the military service. We are employing more people in our military, and of course also we go for more defense material. What we will bring, we are strong on the water, under the water, and in the sky. And together with Finland, that they're very strong on the ground, I think we together will really provide for more security to NATO.
And one personal curiosity, do you get a sense that Norway is really glad to have two new allies that know how to ski?
Yes.
Cold weather.
And know
cold
about
expertise.
Yes, when I was visiting Cold Response up in the northern part of Norway this spring, and spoke to the Norwegian military there, and also the Swedes and Finns that were part of this operation, and they all said it was very good for soldiers from some countries where there's not so much snow to practice in the northern part of Norway, because they were not used to the conditions. So now there will be two other allies that are used to ice, snow, and very cold weather, minus 40 degrees.
And speaking of Norway, Lily also spoke this week with Norwegian Prime Minister Jonas Gahr Støre at the NATO summit. While Norway isn't a member of the European Union, of course, its cooperation with the EU and NATO is of key strategic importance for European security.
With Sweden and Finland set to join the alliance, from your perspective, from a Norwegian perspective, how does this change the security situation in the north and the security landscape?
At the outset, the security landscape has been stable. has been marked by what we in Norway call high north, low tension. Norway has shared a border with the Soviet Union and then Russia. And while being a member of NATO, managing a balanced relationship of cooperation and also necessary deterrence next to a big military power. I foresee that that will be the approach by all five Nordics inside NATO. It is clear that Russia's invasion in Ukraine was a trigger point for Sweden and Finland to make this historic move. For Sweden, first time in 200 years, joining a military alliance. And that will, for Norway, give cohesion in the five-country Nordic region. It will strengthen what I would say is a common approach to security and cooperation inside NATO, around the NATO table. And for Norway, being an ocean-oriented country by its geography, it means that we will get greater cohesion with the landmass of the Nordic region. So the opportunity to have better interoperability, more common training, planning, and the link between defense and security and the broad European cooperation will be enhanced.
You talked about a stable situation in the north. We had news during the summit of a cyber attack targeting Norwegian institutions. And I believe the authorities said, or pointed rather, to criminal Russian, pro-Russian group rather. Do you believe that there is potentially any link between that attack and the NATO summit, or perhaps the expansion of NATO in the region?
You know, we are left to speculate. Mm-hmm. And this is apparently a criminal network which is called pro-Russian, and I will not go farther to link them in any other direction. This was an attack which was, I think, handled well back in Norway. It led to some internet pages being down for a few minutes. But, of course, it's an illustration on what we highlight in the strategic concept of NATO, that hybrid attacks, cyber attacks, is part of the new security landscape and the threats that we need to face, both to prevent but also to deal with when they occur.
And in terms of the new force posture that NATO leaders have signed off on, is Norway planning to contribute troops to this new high readiness force under this force model?
Well, we will be part of that on a rotational basis. I mean, right now we have troops in Lithuania contributing to solidarity. I mean, NATO, let's not forget that it is a defensive alliance looking after security of member states. There is no offensive element in this. And Norway wants to be part of that. You know, we have allied training in my country at the large NATO exercise this year called Response. There were about 30,000 troops from 27 different countries exercising along the Norwegian coast. And we want to be present in other NATO countries, providing the same security guarantee that we receive. This is part of the reciprocity of NATO.
The new strategic concept, which you approved during this summit, of course, has much, much stronger language on Russia than the previous one. Do you believe that the alliance got the right tone from your perspective?
I think it's been a balanced message from NATO. I mean, look to Ukraine, the daily destruction, the extraordinary, brutal use of military force. Obviously, 10 years ago, I was also, or 12 years ago, I was present at the NATO summit adapting the former strategic concept. I was foreign minister, and then we had the aspiration of a partnership with Russia. But, you know, that those days seems to be gone. And I think, you know, it's necessary to formulate that Russia is perceived to be a threat. The countries bordering Ukraine and that region can feel that directly. And NATO solidarity indicates that we take the necessary measures.
Just moving on to a slightly different subject, but we are a Brussels-based publication, so one issue we cover is also energy security, especially for the European Union countries. And recently, I believe, your government reached an agreement with the EU to help provide more gas. Are there other ways where you see maybe more cooperation on energy security and helping out maybe some of the EU states?
Well, I mean, we deliver at the maximum what we can, plus a little bit on top of that, you know. So the gas exports will be according to the contracts that have been made. plus an additional volume of LNG, because we have brought LNG to the market from an upgraded industrial LNG plant. What we see now, I believe, is a complete merger of energy security, climate policy and security policy. You know, they are now interlinked. And the war in Ukraine and Russia's gas trade and the way they use gas is leading NATO, European countries, to take unprecedented measures to be independent. That is leading to a major push for new renewables, you know, in wind on land, offshore wind, hydrogen, solar, which is necessary from a climate change perspective. So in that sense, you know, it is accelerating a development we need to see happen. And Norway is very much part of that by developing further our renewable energy source, water, hydro water, but also the offshore wind potential. So this is now, during these months, materialized in a much closer industrial cooperation with Germany, with the European Union, discussed here in Madrid with Belgium. So that, I believe, will continue, and it is highly necessary. We must expect a pretty tough winter, you know, winter 22-23, because of the energy situation, and I hope to see that there is solidarity among European nations also on this issue.
Thanks again to Lily and David for bringing us those conversations from Madrid. And that's all the time we have on this episode of EU Confidential. Be sure to follow the podcast wherever you're listening so you never miss an episode. And remember that you can get in touch with us with your feedback or ideas for guests or topics. You just have to email podcast@politico.eu. I'm Sarah Wheaton in Brussels. Thanks this week to our intern, Namratha Prasad, our editor, James Randerson, and our executive producer, Christina Gonzalez. And thanks to you for listening.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.